You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. You will recall some weeks ago I was saying, actually it was some months ago, I've said it a number of times over the last few months, time to get out of everything. Get into cash. Get out of gold. Get out of oil. Get out of whatever, you know, it's in my opinion. I mean, it's just, I'm not offering investment advice. I'm just saying. And the stock's summer slide, I guess, is happening right now. The Dow is down about 300 points. It'll bounce back. This will be a buying opportunity for some people. This bubble still has a long way to go, in my opinion. But still, what we're seeing are the wobbles that indicate that it's problematic, shall we say. Maryland has done, oh, by the way, Lamar Waldron is going to be with us a little later on in the show. This week, next week, or maybe last week and this week, are a whole bunch of really significant Watergate anniversaries. And Lamar has a new book out about Watergate and what an incredible crook Nixon was. And you will find this very entertaining and very interesting. And Lamar is going to be on, I believe, in our third hour. Yeah, in our third hour. So 2 hours hence. Now, I wanted to tell you what Maryland is doing. This is just the coolest thing. Maryland has come up with what they call the Genuine Progress Indicator. Now, this is a variation on the Gross National Happiness Index, which is a variation on what the King of Bhutan has been using for his nation. The GNH, and that's got a whole bunch, you know, that has psychological well-being, health, time use, education, cultural diversity and resilience, good governance, community vitality, ecological diversity and resilience, and living standards. But this one, Maryland is actually apparently going to put into place. Governor O'Malley, the Democratic governor of Maryland, just describe the limitations of traditional GDP. In fact, Shano, you've got a clip of Bobby Kennedy, RFK, back in the day, talking about GDP, and it just brilliantly illustrates the problems with using productivity or gross domestic product as the only way that you look at an economy. And we've been doing that now for about the 100 years or so that we've been seriously having, you know, economists, and maybe not even 100 years, but it's been, you know, within the last 100 years that we've been looking at economic things, creating economic models, trying to figure out how to make an economy that works. And what we came up with was what used to be called gross domestic product or gross GDP. It was gross national product before that. And I think Bobby Kennedy refers to it as GNP. And what gross national product is basically the sum of all the purchases, all the economic transactions happening, you know, things being bought and sold, and, you know, wages being paid and bonuses being paid and dividends and all that kind of, that's all GNP or GDP. And so the problem with that is if you have a forest fire and you have to spend $30 million putting it out, you know, a state, that's considered $30 million worth of economic activity. GNP is all considered positive, right? Let's have GNP grow. And here's what Robert F. Kennedy had to say about it back in, I believe this was 67, as I recall. I don't know for sure the year, but I'm pretty sure this was 67, the year before he was assassinated. Here he is.
Too much and for too long, we seem to have surrendered personal excellence and community value in the mere accumulation of material things. Our gross national product now is over $800 billion a year. But that gross national product, if we judge the United States of America by that gross national product counts air pollution and cigarette advertising and ambulances to clear our highways of carnage. It counts special locks for our doors and the jails for the people who break them. It counts the destruction of the redwoods and the loss of our natural wonder in chaotic sprawl. It counts napalm, and it counts nuclear warheads and armored cars for the police to fight the riots in our city. It counts Whitman's rifle and Speck's knife and the television programs which glorify violence in order to sell toys to our children. Yet the gross national product does not allow for the health of our children, the quality of their education, or the joy of their play. It does not include the beauty of our poetry, or the strength of our marriages, the intelligence of our public debate, or the integrity of our public officials. It measures neither our wit nor our courage, neither our wisdom nor our learning, neither our compassion nor our devotion to our country. It measures everything in short, except that which makes life worthwhile. And it can tell us everything about America, except why we are proud that we are Americans.
So it was, you know, one of the most brilliant speeches. I mean, Bobby Kennedy gave a lot of brilliant speeches, but that was right up there. And it's rightly one of his most famous. And he identified this problem with gross national product, what's now called gross domestic product. And so Maryland is going to do something about this. They're going to say, we're not going to measure, you know, Whitman's rifle or Speck's knife or vice versa, whichever it was. They were, you know, a couple of mass killers of their day. We're not going to, you know, or at least we're going to measure those things, but we're going to measure them as negatives rather than as positives. We're going to measure the nuclear weapons and the napalm as negatives rather than positives. And so here's how they're putting this thing together. They take personal consumption expenditures, and then they adjust that for income inequality. So that modifies it, reduces, you know, the more inequality, the more it reduces it. And then they add in services of consumer durables. In other words, that's a good thing. People are repairing things. And then they take out the cost of consumer durables and take out the cost of underemployment, add in net capital investment, and then they take out the following. These are things that now become negatives that up until this point we have been counting as positives, and so have really, in our tax code and the way we do business has essentially encouraged. These will now become negatives in the state of Maryland. Cost of water pollution, air pollution, noise pollution, net wetland change, net farmland change, net forest cover change, climate change, ozone depletion, non-renewable energy resource depletion. Now, that's kind of in the environmental area. They're going to subtract all those negatives. Then they're going to add in the positive value of homework, volunteer time, higher education, and services of highways and streets, and deduct out the cost of family change, the cost of crime, the cost of personal pollution abatement, the cost of lost leisure time, the cost of commuting, and the cost of motor vehicle crashes. And when you do the math on all that, what you end up with is what they call the genuine process indicator, the GPI. This is a great step forward. This is like a really good positive thing. And the governor, Governor O'Malley, he said, no one benchmark, no one measure, no one indicator paints a full picture of a city, state, or country's progress. He says, our country's GDP has doubled over the last three decades. You just heard Bobby Kennedy say it's $800 billion. That was 1967. It's $15 trillion now. It was just, you know, it was 8/10 of $1 trillion back then. He said, so O'Malley says, yet things like income inequality, middle class opportunity, the amount of poisonous carbon pumped into our atmosphere, these graphs are not moving in the right direction. GDP tells us what we are producing, the governor said, but it totally neglects what we are using up. There is a difference between income, which is fleeting, and wealth, which is lasting. Brilliantly said. We'll be back 15 minutes past three.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And we'll keep track of what's going on in the market. I got to tell you about what's going on in China right now, also with their banksters. And we'll be picking up your calls. Past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, the Maryland Genuine Progress Indicator, I think that's a, you know, that's an important thing. But, Howard Kurtz is leaving CNN for Fox News. that's not so important, but it's interesting. It's remarkable, all this stuff that the Supreme Court today. This is actually a big deal. The Supreme Court today issued a bunch of decisions, and one of them was, and the Center for American Progress has done a really good analysis of this. This was a 5-3 ruling, and I'm guessing it was the usual five right-wingers. And the reason it was it wasn't 5-4 was because Sonia Sotomayor recused herself. But basically, businesses have been doing this more and more and more as time goes on, saying to us, sign this contract in order to do business with us. And when you look at the fine print in the contract, it says you are giving up your right to sue. Okay? You're giving up your right to sue. Now, the Seventh Amendment, Amendment number 7, says, in suits at common law where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved, and no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise reexamined in any court of the United States than according to the rules of the common law. In other words, you have the right to sue somebody in court. But what these corporations are doing is they're putting these I will not sue, I will go to arbitration clauses in, where instead of going to a jury and instead of actually suing, you go to an arbitration panel. And more often than not, these panels are made up of corporate-friendly folks, and they rule in favor of corporations, or they split the, you know, they do a Solomonic split the baby in half kind of thing, and people end up screwed. And by the way, it eliminates the ability of people to organize together and form a class action lawsuit, which is one of the ways that little people who have been hurt can take on great big corporations. For example, the tobacco litigation was a class action lawsuit. You get, you know, thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people together and sue a company. So what apparently what American Express had done was in their contracts with the people who, you know, they're merchants that take their cards. They said, okay, if you're going to take our card, they apparently changed the terms of this or some. I don't have all the details on this, but basically said, you know, we're changing the terms. And by the way, if you want to, you know, if you're going to get upset about it, and a bunch of people did get upset about it and tried to sue them in a class action, and they said, no, you sign an agreement that says you have to go to arbitration. And so, in fact, in 2011, the Center for American Progress notes, they issued one of the worst blows to consumer rights in years when they held that consumers challenging $30 fees could not sue together as a class. They did the same thing again today. And so, with Thursday's ruling, the court added small businesses to the list of aggrieved parties whose access to the courthouse has been foreclosed by boilerplate contracts that prohibits parties from filing their challenge as a class. And this is by Nicole Flatow on the Think Progress Justice blog. So it's this is a major big deal. Oh, and here's one. This has got me scratching my head. Exodus International. Michelle Bachmann's husband runs a business where he converts gay people to straight people by praying with them. So Marcus Bachmann spends most of his days, or at least used to, and she's a partner in the business, I guess, hanging out with gay men and helping them become straight or something. Exodus International was the biggest of the institutions that was doing this. And it was founded by a fellow by the name of Alan Chambers, who is married to his wife, Leslie, or was. And Chambers came out against this therapy a short while ago in a public statement, and over the last week has published an apology on the website of Exodus International. Now, you know, the thing that baffles me is why nobody has gone out and asked Marcus Bachmann about this, although probably the main reason that they're not is because Michelle Bachmann is not going to run for re-election, so she's kind of old news, so who cares? And she's not running for re-election because she probably would have gone to jail otherwise, as far as we can tell. It looks like she avoided prosecution for campaign finance law violations or other you know, financial violations, misuse of funds, by saying, okay, I won't run for re-election. But, you know, is her husband still in this business? I don't know. But anyhow, Chambers wrote, Alan Chambers of Exodus International, he said, please know that I am deeply sorry. I'm sorry for the pain and hurt many of you have experienced. I'm sorry that some of you spent years working through the shame and guilt you felt when your attractions didn't change. I am sorry we promoted sexual orientation change efforts and reparative therapies about sexual orientation that stigmatized parents. I am sorry that there were times I didn't stand up to people publicly on my side who called you names like sodomite or worse. I am sorry that I, knowing some of you so well, failed to share publicly that the gay and lesbian people I know were every bit as capable of being amazing parents as the straight people I know. I am sorry that when I celebrate a person coming to Christ and surrendering their sexuality to him, that I callously celebrated the end of relationships that broke your heart. I am sorry that I have communicated that you and your families are less than me and mine. That's pretty amazing. I'm wondering, it seems to me like, you know, who's going to go into the gay, convert gay people to straight people business? Except somebody who is probably gay and trying to pretend that they're not. And I'm wondering if Alan Chambers has, like, come out or just kind of reconciled this within himself. But who knows? Finally they've done the right thing. This is the largest of these organizations that say that they can talk people out of being gay. Good stuff. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Right after the news, your calls, more of the news of the day, and my thoughts on both. It's your media support group for We the People. Talk media for the sane among us, the Tom Hartman Program. James Gandolfini has died. You've all heard about it already. It's been all over the news. It's everywhere. You know, Tony Soprano, among other things. He was a brilliant actor, brilliant character actor, played many, many roles. He's most famous for being Tony Soprano. He apparently had a heart attack in Italy a day or so ago and died at the age of, I believe, 51, which is damn young.
I might say it's very young.
As a guy who's more than a decade older than he is. So, anyhow, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, let's see. Is there a date on this? No, I don't have a date on it. But it was a couple of weeks ago. You'll recall I was promoting it here on the air. I said, I'm going out to Los Angeles, and we're going to do a fundraiser with Mimi Kennedy and Lily Tomlin, and James Gandolfini may be there, and, you know, come on and show up. It's a fundraiser for Progressive Democrats of America for Tim Carpenter's group, pdamerica.org. And, Jim says it was June 1st. Thank you. So it was just 17, 18, 20 days ago. And James Gandolfini had been invited to join us. The headliners were Lily Tomlin and me. And boy, is she a wonderful and gracious woman, by the way. I have seen her perform both live and on TV forever. In person, she is such a wonderful and gracious woman. It was really, really an honor and a pleasure to meet Lily Tomlin. James Gandolfini couldn't make it because there was a wedding he had to go to that day, and that he just couldn't get out of, and it just, you know, the time conflicted. And so he sent this note, which... I'm pretty sure either Mimi or Tim, one of the people, I think it was Mimi, read to the people who were there. So, you know, this was basically his message. And I'm going to insert the beginning, which is a couple of sentences, of personal sentences that he wrote to Mimi and Linda. I don't think he would mind. But these are not literally James Gandolfini's last words, but damn close. Maybe his last political words. I don't know. He wrote, "Dear Mimi and Linda," this was about coming to participate. He said, "Thanks for those kind words. I had really worked up in my mind a couple of things I had wanted to say, and I'm still trying to find a way over there from the wedding. I'm working on it." And then he says, "I believe we have failed as a generation. This is James Gandolfini. I believe we have failed as a generation. We have allowed things to go on the last 30 to 40 years on our watch that we should have seen earlier and worked harder to stop. I am of that Italian peasant sensibility instilled from my father that says, take care of the ones you love and are closest to, do the right thing to others, and don't get involved with the government or the boss. They are not your friend. They are not to be dealt with unless absolutely necessary. But now it is necessary. So I will help in any way I can and feel comfortable with. Please ask me to future events. I will get a $5,000 check to you guys if I can't get there. Sincerely, James Gandolfini. And Mimi read that to everybody at the fundraiser. But that's just like the fact that he was very political and very progressive. And a supporter of Progressive Democrats of America, PDAmerica.org. And it's kind of sad that I see none of that in any of the eulogies or obituaries anywhere. So I just wanted to put that out there for your consideration. So all of that said, let's pick up some calls here. Janet in Topeka, Kansas. Hey, Janet, what's on your mind?
Oh, I had been thinking about this economy thing for quite a long time, watching what's going on. Mm-hmm. Of course, we lost a lot in the big blow-up. But it occurs to me that we make a mistake when we look at Wall Street and all of the money they're making and then ask the question, where are the jobs? It occurs to me that quite possibly our economy is bifurcated. Wow. That's the only way I can describe it. In that Wall Street that economy is primarily financialized.
Mm-hmm.
What they do is deal in financial instruments, not in bricks and mortar.
Right.
But we don't think about this, and you can understand that, there's no investment in capital, labor,
right.
Bricks and mortar stuff. They can make a lot more money just sitting back and swapping back and forth with each other.
Yep. This is what Reaganomics brought us. If you go back and you look at the statistics from before the Reagan administration until today, before Reagan came into office, the financial services industry in aggregate was less than 10% of our economy. I forget the exact number. I've done op-eds on this, somewhere between 7 and 11%. I know for sure it was in that range. And today it's in the neighborhood of
hang on just a minute.
Don't drink miso soup before you go on the air. A piece of seaweed caught my throat. Okay, now today, it's somewhere between 20 and 30%, or 30, maybe as much as 35% of our economy. And it's more than, or in the neighborhood of tripled. In the same time, manufacturing has gone from being roughly a third of our economy down to about 11% of our economy. So we've seen this flip where manufacturing used to be the basis of our economy. Now financialization is. And you're absolutely right. There's no actual wealth produced out of financialization. It's just money. It's not really wealth. It's income, and income is not wealth, which, as the governor of Maryland just pointed out.
Right, right. I really worry about that because they're in hyper mode at this point. With their financial swaps, credit default swaps, and instruments that they buy and sell to each other.
Yes.
Did
you see what's happening in China?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So overnight, last night, the Chinese markets froze up. The Chinese banks stopped lending to each other at overnight interbank rates. The rates spiked to 25%. They were 14.5%, as I recall, at the opening today. What would have been today back in China. It's probably the middle of the night now. And there's speculation. Nobody's really sure what's going on. There's a couple of possible scenarios. One is that the Chinese financial system is actually collapsing, that it's the exact same thing that happened when Lehman Brothers collapsed here and the financial markets froze up. And, we had to make the decision, do we kill off the banks or nationalize them the way Reagan did with the SNLs and Sweden did with their banks in 98? Or do we bail out the banks, which is what Bush ended up deciding to do? And and you know, just let them get bigger and bigger. And so is it that that's happening, A, or is it B, that what's going on is that the government has been putting the squeeze on the banks, and they have been for the last 6 months or so. They've been slowly reducing the amount of capital available to banks by reducing by increasing liquidity requirements and reducing available capital through the Chinese Central Bank. Are they, and is this just the consequence of that, and is this the outcome that they actually wanted because, you know, they want the banks to behave in a more responsible fashion, or they want to, you know, diminish the power of the banking sector? Or is it C, that the banks, that there in China there have been this, there's this unique thing that we sort of had here in the United States with derivatives, but derivatives were mostly played, you know, they were investment instruments that were played by big boys. You know, they were played by the Mitt Romneys. If you wanted to get into the derivatives market, it used to, up until, you know, just a decade and a half ago, if you wanted to buy stock in a hedge fund, you had to prove that you had net worth of $500,000 that you could afford to lose. So, you know, the derivative market became a multi-trillion dollar, it's, you know, $600 trillion unregulated market in the United States, or worldwide right now. The U.S. portion of that's probably around $250 to $350 trillion. But in China, the banks are creating financial instruments for individuals to invest in that are not secured, that are not on the books, and there's a name for them. It's in the New York Times article about it today, and that is not at the tip of my fingers. I'm sorry. And but these are like phony financial instruments. You know, they're just made up things. And there's speculation that this is an attempt by the government to wring those out of the bank. Although why the government wouldn't simply regulate those out of the banks or out of the banking sector, I don't know. But the world is watching with some worry.
Well, and prior to the big blow up, China and has been for years the major purchaser of our debt. But how much of our economy is actually debt?
Well, not so much actually. They're the major purchaser, they're the major foreign purchaser of our government debt. We actually, the real debt problem in the United States is not government debt. Government debt stands at around $16-17 trillion. The real problem that we have in this country is private sector debt. Private sector debt is over $35 billion. And $35 trillion. And that's a mind-boggling, you know, $17 trillion of government debt, $35 trillion plus of private sector debt. Steve Dean was on our program, the Australian economist, talking about this a few months ago. And if that goes south, and that's what started to go south back in 2008, if or when that goes south, it's going to really take things down. And that's apparently a factor in what's going on in China, too. So we live, Jana, thank you for the call. We live in a time of incredible economic instability. And so it's time to either get totally debt-free or just totally max out on debt, one or the other.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And then just get ready to bail. Actually, don't take that as investment advice. I'm just, you know. Whoa, this is interesting. Welcome back. Just got this note from BJ. Gay or straight, Alan Chambers addresses confusion over his sexuality. Alan Chambers is the guy who is, like, converting gays or helping them, you know, reparation therapy, helping them become straight people. And amid confusion about his sexual identity, Exodus International President Alan Chambers has released statements over the last week clarifying recent remarks that he is neither gay nor heterosexual. He says, am I homosexual? I don't know. And then he says, I have Leslie attractions. I have opposite sex attractions toward my wife. He's married. Leslie is his wife's name. It's very interesting. This sounds like a man who is really, really struggling. I wish him well. Particularly given this apology that he's put out, he needs our empathy and our prayers, not our derision. Libby in Seattle. Hey, Libby.
Hey there.
What's up?
Well, I just wanted to commend you and encourage you to stay with amending the Constitution and supporting Move to Amend.
I think that's our number one hope. It's not our only hope, but it's our number one hope.
Right. I'm on a steering committee in the state of Washington where we're starting to do a citizens initiative to be on the November 2014 ballot.
That's great.
And it's a big campaign, so that it's interesting being in the trenches on this struggle.
Yeah, I had Ben Cohen.
I wanted to let you know also that to that end, my husband last week wrote took the old MTA song that you'll remember from the Kingston Trio.
Mm-hmm.
And
you mean he'll never return? No, he'll never return because his fate is still unknown.
Right.
Yeah.
Charlie on the Boston subway.
Yeah, on the Boston subway. Yeah.
Right.
The red line and the blue line.
I just sent to our email the parody. It's a YouTube clip.
Oh, that's great.
And I sent you the lyrics also in a separate attachment.
Oh, that's great.
I'd love for you to take a look at it because I think a lot of people really know that song and love that song. And we've sung it at a number of places, pass out the lyrics, and people just jump right in and start singing it. And it's all about overturning Citizens United.
That's marvelous. Well, I look forward to checking that out. The yourtakemytake@gmail.com account goes right to Kurt Gardinier, who is our producer, one of our producers at the Big Picture. And he's the guy who's responsible for getting them, you know, into video and on the air and all that kind of stuff. So, and I will see him in about 2.5 hours, and so I'll ask him.
Perfect. Well, Paul gives his permission for that song to be used by anybody in the country. Just get a banjo and some guitars and voices together.
Great.
This could be a battle cry for amending the Constitution is our vision.
That's great. Well, if you're sending it to yourtakemytake@gmail.com, be sure and enclose or attach to it or send another one that is basically you or your husband looking at the camera saying, Tom, what do you think about this? And there's put a question in there that I can answer so that I can play it on the air and then I can react to it.
I did that already in that email that I already sent.
Great. Okay.
I asked you to comment on it.
That's great. That should be a lot of fun. Libby, thank you for the call. Thanks for your activism. Keep it up, okay?
All right. Will do. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Great talking with you. Tony in Waldport, Oregon. Hey, Tony, what's up?
Oh, gosh. I've been wanting to do this forever and a day. I watch you all the time, and I watch Amy, too. I'm a subscriber, too.
Mm-hmm.
I just sometimes go off the edge when I see all the money that's being spent on wars, when I see McCain jumping around in glee when we were deciding to go help Syria. And then the people are, Congress is cutting more money away from the poor,
right,
and the kids are starving. I mean, I'm 79 plus years old. What in the hell is happening to our country?
Well, it's misplaced values, Tony. It's 32 years of Reaganomics, and it is this sociopathic ideology of Ayn Rand and Ronald Reagan and the Republican Party that says that the individual is the most important thing and that selfishness is good, greed is good, and that we are not a society. We're a nation made up of individuals, and that Darwinism somehow means that whoever has the most money is the most adapted to survival. And all that is nonsense. And everybody always knew that until the last 30 years. Now you got a whole generation that's grown up believing this stuff. It's amazing to me. I started arguing or debating on the air. We had one of them on a couple of days ago, these young people in their 20s and early 30s who have, you know, they've done is read Atlas Shrugged. You know, they've read Ayn Rand and they think they understand economics in the world. And they have no clue, and they're not old enough to have a memory of what America was like before Reagan. And so they don't know that we actually had a country that worked at one point. You know, it's like, you know, it actually worked pretty well. And it wasn't perfect. But, Tony, I'm with you. I think you've said it very well, and I appreciate that. Thank you very much for the call.
Okay.
Good to hear from you. John in Springfield, Oregon. Hey, John, we got a minute to the top of the hour. Your thoughts on the nuclear option in the Senate?
Yes, I read an article in Politico yesterday how the Congress is talking about the nuclear option, and my thinking is that they're worried about repercussions in the, what the Republicans would do. And my thoughts on that are that there's no way the insurance companies would let the Republicans do away with Obamacare, in that they're looking at all this money coming in per month starting in 2014.
I agree with you. And by that, by the way, there's no way the American people will either, because the American people are getting it that Obamacare is a good deal for them. And they're going to be getting it more and more as we head toward 2016. And they're going to get it in a big way by 2016. I mean, there's just going to be no doubting it. So it's still not as good as single payer, but by that time, you're going to have states like Vermont and Montana actually putting into place or preparing to put into place single payer. So totally with you, John. And, you know, hopefully the rest of America will wake up. By the way, it's not a full nuclear option that Harry Reid is talking about doing. It's a semi-nuclear option. The Senate has advice and consent on both legislation, and they're filibustering that, and presidential appointees. And Harry Reid's talking about blowing up just the presidential appointees part of the filibuster.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. You know, we all know that the banksters only care about the bottom line, right? So only the threat of losing massive year-end bonuses could make them freak out, right? And therefore, they shouldn't care about climate change because that has nothing to do with banking, right? Wrong. Banksters are now freaking out about climate change, too, because it's going to hit their bottom lines and hard. Climate change has the potential to devastate economies, and if that happens, banks will be devastated, too. On Wednesday, the president of the World Bank said that the world should stop arguing about whether humans are the cause of climate change and instead start taking action to curb climate change's devastating effects. At a Thomson Reuters newsmaker event in London yesterday, World Bank President Jim Yong Kim said that there was a 97 to 98% agreement in the scientific community that global warming and climate change are real and that they are caused by human activity. Kim went on to say, if you disagree with the science of human-caused climate change, you are not disagreeing that there is anthropogenic climate change. What you are disagreeing with is science itself. Governments across the planet are already doing something about this. Many have agreed to limit global temperature rises to below 2 degrees Celsius, which is about 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. But the banksters at the World Bank are saying that isn't enough. And they're right. Jim Yong Kim noted in his speech that as extreme weather events continue to get worse and more prevalent, public opinion about climate change should start to change. Referring to the United States, Kim said that, quote, as extreme weather events occur, such as in the Midwest and Hurricane Sandy, etc., other legislators will come around, end quote. Kim then went on to talk about how China, the world's second largest economy, is already taking the issues of global warming and climate change very seriously. In fact, while China is the biggest emitter of carbon dioxide in the world and is still continuing to build dirty coal power plants, they are also investing millions of dollars in solar and wind power, more than any other country in the world. Especially us. Yeah, this should be a good thing. According to Kim, right? This is a positive sign. China's doing this. China's working hard to develop its own national carbon market. And this week, I don't think it has anything to do with their banks freezing up, hopefully. China launched its first emissions trading scheme in the highly industrialized city of Shenzhen. You will recall that back in the late 80s, maybe it was the early 90s, it was, you know, Bush Sr.'s reign of error was from 89 to 92. But, or arguably, you know, January of 93. During that time, he put into place a cap and trade program to get rid of acid rain. He capped the amount of sulfur dioxide that power plants could release because it's fairly easily scrubbed out of the smokestacks. and then allowed banks to trade and speculate on the commodity, basically, of these caps, of these carbon caps. And within a couple of decades, acid rain is no longer a problem. Cap and trade took care of it. So we've done that before. Yong Kim, the president of the World Bank, said that, quote, if we get China, the U.S., and the EU to agree on a price for CO2, we'll have a market mechanism to fight climate change. I hope a practical solution will happen before 2020. End of quote. Now, the European Union has had a carbon market in place since 2005. So, what, 7 years? 8 years? And China is really working hard to try to set up a carbon emissions trading scheme. And like I said, there's one that went into effect this week in Shenzhen, which is one of their largest industrialized cities. It's right across the bay from Hong Kong, well, right across the bay in about a three-hour drive up. I've been there. Louise and I were there back in the early 80s when Shenzhen was a little town of maybe 5,000 people. And, the one restaurant in town we had lunch at and the bathroom was literally a hole in the floor. That was the bathroom. Now it's like this giant industrialized city with a million or more people in it and factories everywhere. And so China's doing it. The EU has been doing it since 2005. China started it this week. But here in the United States, we still have crackpots like every single freshman member of the United States House of Representatives who's a Republican saying not only there's nothing to do anything about, but there ain't even any such thing. You know, Bill McKibben back last summer in a Rolling Stone article pointed out that the fossil fuel industry is the only industry in the United States that doesn't have to pay to have its waste disposed of. Think about that. If you're a restaurant owner, you have to pay to have somebody come pick up your leftovers. If you're an office manager, you pay to have somebody recycle all your used papers. If you own a construction company, you pay to have someone haul off the waste materials from a construction site. But with the good old fossil fuel industry, you and I are left to pay the cost of their waste. Their waste, of course, being carbon dioxide. And these costs come in the form of higher food prices thanks to climate change-driven droughts and massive cleanup efforts thanks to climate change-driven superstorms like Hurricane Sandy. We don't pay for restaurants to dispose of their trash. So why should we have to pay for big oil to dispose of theirs? I mean, yesterday, senior White House officials said that President Obama is preparing regulations that would limit CO2 emissions from existing power plants. According to the New York Times, if those regulations go through, they would mark, quote, the most consequential climate policy step he could take, end quote. Although I'd say turning down the Keystone XL pipeline is probably the most, well, you know, flip a coin. But in any case, that's, you know, just doing it through the EPA is not enough. America needs a carbon tax. And we need it now. We need some real way of accounting for the real cost of carbon. Is it $30 a ton? Is it $50 a ton? Is it $80 a ton? Is it $100 a ton? A lot of estimates now are suggesting that the actual cost of this carbon dioxide, the cost that you and I are paying, is more like $120 a ton. If we want to have any hope of combating the greatest threat that this planet has ever faced. During his speech in Berlin, Germany yesterday, President Obama spoke to the crowd about climate change. Here he is.
The effort to slow climate change requires bold action. And on this, Germany and Europe have led. In the United States, we have recently doubled our renewable energy from clean sources like wind and solar power. We're doubling fuel efficiency on our cars. Our dangerous carbon emissions have come down, but we know we have to do more. And we will do more. With a global middle class consuming more energy every day, this must now be an effort of all nations, not just some. For the grim alternative affects all nations. More severe storms, more famine and floods, new waves of refugees, coastlines that vanish, oceans that rise. This is the future we must avert. This is the global threat of our time. And for the sake of future generations, Our generation must move toward a global compact to confront a changing climate before it is too late. That is our job. That is our task. We have to get to work.
There you go. President Obama's right. But it's going to take more than a speech. It's time for us to start taking the bold actions needed to save our planet, and that starts right now. For once, let's put the interests of big oil aside, put a price on this carbon dioxide waste, and help preserve the future of the only planet that you and I, as far as we know of right now, the only planet that you and I can call home. Time for a carbon tax. Cap and trade, halfway. Hey, it's better than nothing, but a carbon tax, that's the easy solution. Put a carbon tax on it, all of a sudden, all of the alternative energy sources become cheaper than fossil fuels. Hey.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Even the free market theoreticians would acknowledge that that would work. I mean, they may want to take some more money from the coal industry, but they would acknowledge it. Hey, it's Thursday. Time for my the time that Sean and Louise give me 3 minutes to talk about science. How are you? I thought you like science, dude. Yes, it's our geeky science moment. It's hard not to listen to the sounds of birds chirping away. You know, it's their little birdie songs. And in this age of technology, people have tried to capture the sound of birds via mobile phone apps. You can get these apps. You know, they're in the app stores, and Apple has them, and all the other, you know. But it turns out, scientists are discovering that some of these recorded bird songs may actually be harmful to real live birds. And one nature reserve has told visitors to stop using bird song apps to attract birds because the apps may disrupt the normal bird behaviors. According to officials at the Brown Sea Island Nature Reserve in the UK, use of the bird song apps, quote, is not suitable for nature reserves and can be potentially harmful to sensitive species, end quote. Why? Because birds use their songs to do a variety of things. They're not just singing country music. They do it to establish a territory, they do it to attract mates, and they do it to sound warning calls. Calls that could be used to tell other birds, hey, good food over here, or watch out, there's a predator nearby. And since spring is the breeding season for a wide variety of birds, during the spring, many birds are hyper aware of the songs of other birds. And birds hear recorded bird songs coming from phone apps and easily get distracted from important activities like mating or gathering food. You're freaking them out. While most bird song apps aren't specifically designed to attract birds, it seems to be an unintended consequence. The Brownlee Reserve has now posted signs warning visitors not to use no bird song apps here. So now you know why those birds are so angry all the time, right? The old angry birds. Yeah, sorry. Bad joke. Anyhow, that's our geeky science. Today, 145 former Obama campaign staffers have come out publicly, published a letter today. These were staffers, people who were, you know, who worked, who were paid to work on the Obama for President campaign. 145 of them in 2008-2012. And well, here's their letter. Mr. President, we are just a few of the millions of young people across the country who are frightened at the prospect of runaway climate change. One of the reasons we came to work for you in the first place is because we trust you understand how big this challenge is. Dozens of supporters across the country told us they were casting their ballot for someone they could count on to make the tough call when it came to our security and our health care and our climate. They voted for you, Mr. President, because we told them you'd be on the right side of history when you had to make these calls, because we knew you'd do the right thing and stop this pipeline. His former staff members saying to him, stop the Keystone XL pipeline. That's a great one. Charles in Montgomery, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Hey, Charles, what's on your mind there?
Yes, Tom. A little bit earlier, you had a lady on talking about the economics and how we're watching Wall Street and nothing else.
Financialization, yeah.
Exactly. It used to be, before I'd say 2002, we had one of the leading market indicators was the gross domestic product of the United States.
Right.
And the I forgot which agency of the government decided to change it to include services and banking, because I think that they were trying to hide from the American people that the gross domestic product was going down substantially because of everything made in China.
I assumed it had always included banking. There was a point of time you're suggesting where we started including banking as financialization was taking hold?
I think we did.
Huh.
And because I know before it was actual brick and mortar and manufacturing here in the U.S. and all of our everything we grew, everything we
made, and everything we sold, everything we bought, all
exactly.
of our salaries, all of the our investments and our investment returns. Right.
But then it got twisted under Bush, and I wonder if anybody has done a survey to find out what the actual real gross domestic product would have been since...
If we didn't include financialization.
Yes, and also since Bush gave most favored trade status to China.
To China, yes. That would be... Was that... that was Bush Sr., wasn't it? Or was that Bush Jr.?
That was
Bush Jr.?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
So that would be... That would be a really interesting graph to come up with, to just start, just take, let's assume that GDP and GNP have always included banking. I genuinely think they have. But if you were to start reversing banking out of them, what would that do to the GDP curve over time? My guess is it would slide downwards. It would slide downwards significantly since the so-called Reagan Revolution. Very, very interesting. Charles, thanks for calling and sharing that. I'm going to have to do some digging on that one. Mark in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Mark, you got a minute to the break. What's up?
I just wanted to piggyback on this idea of Citizens United. People are getting discouraged about, it's overwhelming because of the size. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, and I got it, well, basically, if we could use what Tom DeLay and Republicans in Texas in 2003 did and to take back the House.
You mean to unreverse gerrymandering?
Gerrymandering, yes.
Yeah, to reverse the gerrymandering, to say we're not going to recognize those newly drawn congressional districts?
Right. And
the problem is it's in the Constitution. It's in the Constitution that Congress every 10 years has to take a census, and then they have to redraw congressional districts based on it. So it would take, the details of it aren't in the Constitution. They're written as law, and so we could pass a law saying that I think that we should simply pass a law saying that congressional districts have to be polygons. They have to they can't be salamanders anymore. But, Mark, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Gerrymandering is one of those abuses of power, although it goes all the way back to the early 19th century, maybe even before that. Welcome back to the place where we dare to say or ask, is Walmart a person? We dare to say... Oh, not a chance. Gus in New York City, listening on WWRL. Hey, Gus, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I was wondering if I could get your impression about what's going on in New York State in the last couple of days. As you know, around the country, that there's all these state legislatures are trying to take away abortion rights and they're trying to add new regulations. Mm-hmm. But Governor Cuomo here in New York, as the state's Senate legislature session was ending, tried to pass a bill that would actually codify a woman's abortion rights in New York State.
Right. I don't know that. I didn't know that. So I can't really comment on it.
Well, it got taken out of the package. There was like a woman's equality package, and it had 9 provisions, and the one provision that was contested was the one that would guarantee a woman's right to have an abortion if she chooses,
right,
even if Roe v. Wade is overturned in the future on the national level.
Right, which is, so, which is, by the way, the essence of what the House was trying to do yesterday or the day before when they passed the 20-week thing, because Roe v. Wade basically says you can't have an abortion after 24 weeks, and by pushing it up to 20 weeks, what, even though abortions at that point in time are very, very rare, they're like 1.5% of all abortions, but nonetheless, what they're doing by coming up with a different standard than Roe v. Wade is they're setting up a constitutional battle. They're setting up a battle that will go before the Supreme Court in the hopes that, you know, the current Supreme Court, if they can get it there fast enough with 5 very conservative Catholics on the bench, and, you know, whether the Catholicism is going to play into it or not, I don't know, but the Catholic Church is probably the major institutional promoter worldwide of making abortion illegal. And, you know, they're trying to get this before the Supreme Court. So,
well, so, you know, you could see what Andrew Cuomo is trying to do,
mm-hmm,
but there's these 4 Democrats. You know, the state Senate here is split.
Yeah.
It's very close.
It's very tight.
And there's 4 breakaway Democrats, the IDC, that formed a power sharing agreement with the Republicans. And, you know, overnight, we heard the news about this yesterday. There was protesters that were blocking the door in the Senate offices of Jeff Klein, the leader of the 4 breakaway Democrats, who took this out, you know, and it also had to do with the fact that campaign finance reform failed, just like in the closing days of the state Senate session. And 20 people were arrested, I heard, too, just late yesterday. And you don't hear about any of this in the national media,
right,
and there's really no state media covering this either.
That's amazing. Gus, I'm going to, yeah, personally, what you are sharing with me is news, and so I thank you for that, and I'll go off in search of it, and we'll talk about it tomorrow. Gus, thanks a lot for the heads up. Lee in Reed Point, Montana, you wanted to talk about GDP and the percentage that is banking?
Yeah, Tom, you was talking about you didn't know what GDP of banking is.
Or what the percentage of GDP banking represented. My recollection was that it's in the neighborhood of the mid-30s.
It's right at 40%.
Today.
Incredible.
Yeah, that is.
Yeah, I read that in an article here a while back. It used to be, before they changed the laws, and I don't remember what year it said it was, something like 15 years ago or 20 years ago, it was only 8%,
yeah,
of our GDP.
Yeah.
But now it's right at 40%.
Yeah. And that puts us at considerable risk. You know, when the main business of your country is either passing money back and forth between people or feeding each other. And
right,
you know, basically we have a service sector and a banking sector, and those are our main industries. When those are your main industries, you're on the road to oblivion as a nation. And
yeah,
we're
really,
not really
shovels or cars or anything.
Yeah. We need to bring manufacturing back to the United States, and we need to do it with a comprehensive industrial policy, a trade policy, and a manufacturing policy. We need to relearn the lessons that Alexander Hamilton taught George Washington in 1791. And the Congress adopted in 1791 that he presented his report on manufacturers, and by 1793, I think it was, that all these things were pretty much adopted.
Well, it comes back to our Free Trade Act, you know.
Yep.
That we can't put tariffs on goods coming into here, but other countries actually have a form of tariffs, like Germany, and if you read the articles on it, they'll actually penalize companies if they don't do things to a certain standard.
Right. Well, there's 2 ways that they do that, or there's 3 ways that they do that. One is they'll create standards that other countries don't match, and so their own local manufacturers will match. We don't do that so much intentionally. Germany is really aggressive about, and Japan are really aggressive about doing that intentionally. The second is with what's called a value-added tax. And what a value-added tax does is at every stage along the way in a multi-stage manufacturing process, every stage as a raw material is made more and more valuable, as the value increases, there's a small tax for that increase in value. So when you mine iron ore out of the ground and you smelt it into pig iron, there's a value-added tax on that. And then when you take that pig iron and you turn it into steel, there's a value-added tax on that. When you take that steel and you turn it into rolled steel, a sheet steel, there's a value-added tax on that. When you turn that steel into the door of a car, there's a value-added tax on that. When you add the door of that car to a car, there's a value-added tax on that. So when you sell the car, there's been all these taxes added to them. And on an average German car manufactured in Germany for export, the value-added tax is around 15.5%. And so what the Germans do is they say, if we are exporting this car out of Germany, because if you're an American buying a German car from Germany, because you're not a German citizen, you don't have to pay the VAT tax, because the VAT tax is a consumption tax on German citizens. And so we're going to reverse out that 15% tax. Now, we used to have a 15% tariff on cars, right, roughly. And actually, it was closer to 20%. But, you know, we did away with that. So we have no tariff, but that VAT tax for them acts as a 15% reduction in cost of an exported car. And on the other hand, if you want to sell an American car into Germany, they're going to say, okay, how much value was added during the manufacturing? We're going to use the formulas that we use here in Germany, and we're going to tax it 15% when it comes into the country at the border. And so that's functionally a tariff, an import tariff. And China does this, Japan does this, South Korea does this, Taiwan does this, Germany does this, France does it. I mean, most of the industrialized countries of the world do this. They have value-added taxes. We don't. And then on top of that, they will also have regulations that have fees associated with them. So they'll say, okay, in order to sell a car, you have to be able to certify that it meets certain standards, and the certification process has a fee associated with it that's equal to 1% of the cost of the car, or whatever. And these kinds of things also function as tariffs, even though they're not. And we don't do that either. So we are standing naked before the world in terms of trade, and the proof of that is 60% of all Americans shop at Walmart at least once a month, according at least to the Walmart ads. And we stand naked before the world. Our manufacturing jobs are gone, and Germany and China and Japan and South Korea are laughing happily all the way to the bank. So I'm with you, Lee. We've got to do something about this. Thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for bringing up one of my favorite topics. By the way, people who really understand this stuff, Bernie Sanders, Sherrod Brown, Peter DeFazio, there's some really good members of Congress on this stuff, on trade. Larry in Williamsburg, Iowa. Hey, Larry, what's up?
This is kind of a crazy idea, but what would you think? Had to let them finish that pipeline, but instead of running oil through, they have to run water down to like the southwest area of the country with all the droughts.
Yeah, the problem is the Keystone Pipeline. I mean, I'm guessing it's going through some areas that are experiencing droughts, but mostly, you know, it's going over a giant aquifer that they're pulling water out of, which is why you fly over that Midwest and you see these green squares and these green round, you know, parts from the irrigation. Somebody called a couple days ago and suggested that, too. It just, you know, the cost of building a pipeline, the social cost, the environmental cost, the, you know, whether it's water or oil, is, you know, it's really, you have to ask, is it worth the cost? And certainly to carry, you know, tar sand sludge slurry down to the Gulf of Mexico so that it can be refined. We get to keep the poison, and then they ship the refined product, the gasoline and diesel fuel, off to China or Mexico or Brazil or England. That makes no sense at all. But good idea, Larry. I mean, you keep them coming. Doug in Tucson, hey. Arizona. Hey, Doug, what's up?
Elizabeth Warren for president. But my question
Amen.
Is, you told me something I didn't know, which was that scrubbers were added to the coal plants, and the acid rain problem was solved.
Well, it hasn't been solved, but it was significantly reduced as a consequence of the cap and trade program that George Herbert Walker Bush put into place on sulfur dioxide.
HW. Okay, yeah. So are the scrubbers still there? And
yes.
If so, why is Robert Kennedy Jr. talking about all the people that are poisoned by mercury and heavy metals and everything?
Well, those scrubbers are only for sulfur dioxide.
Oh.
And I mean, you know, there may be mercury standards. I mean, they may scrub out some of the other things, but they don't do it anywhere near as well as they should. But sulfur dioxide, I mean, acid rain was a real disaster. You had paint peeling off people's cars. You had, you know, ancient statues just disintegrating, buildings falling apart. Acid rain was taking down the world. And so all around the world, cap and trade programs about sulfur dioxide, which converts to sulfuric acid in the atmosphere and then comes down as rain. getting sulfur dioxide, which is basically sulfur mixed with, you know, a couple of oxygen atoms, the sulfur coming out of the coal, to scrub that out. Apparently, sulfur dioxide is fairly easy to suck out of the exhaust pipe of a coal-fired power plant. Doug, thanks a lot for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And we are, boy, we're going to get into, in the next hour, Mark Weisbrot is going to be here. We're going to talk about what's going on in Brazil, what's going on in China. Lamar Walden's going to be here about Watergate. Exposing the con in conservative. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Steve in Statesville, North Carolina. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Good to talk to you. I heard something on another progressive show yesterday. This lady, I think she wrote a book called Deaths in the Desert. And this is all going back to the immigration thing. This lady brought to my attention that the free trade that we had passed through created a bunch of industry right across the border in Mexico.
Right.
Maquiladora. Yeah, the South Americans and the people seeking jobs came there to get those jobs. You know, they want to feed their families. Mm. And with the free trade there, all our jobs went to Mexico. Then apparently trade with China became cheaper to employ people in China, so all the industry went to China.
Right.
Now all those people were left standing around with the land that they were farming was given to the industry to build industry. Now the industry's gone, and they can't farm the land, so they crossed the border in the United States to feed their families and get employment, you know, and they're here undocumented, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, my take on the whole thing is these greedy corporations pushed our legislators into passing NAFTA
mm-hmm.
to give us free trade to them so they could go wherever they want to seek cheap labor to increase the bottom line. Okay, it bothers me that you know there's deaths in the desert right now. Seems like every day these people they're humans. You know, it's a human effect that's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
People are trying to feed their families.
Yep.
And because of the corporate greed in this country and the world in general, it's going from one country to another country, exporting the natural resources and labor. And these corporations have found every little trick they could find to keep from paying taxes. And like what you was talking about earlier with the, you know, the coal-burning companies and the gas and fuel industries are polluting our air,
yep.
but they're not paying for the sickness that comes along with it, the allergy problems, the asthma, emphysema, cancer. You know, the list goes on and on.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I guess, what I'm trying to get at is I seem to try to follow the news.
Sounds like what you're saying is that the original sin was NAFTA and the free trade agreements.
I think, okay.
And I would agree with that.
Republicans and some Democrats, mostly Republicans, that they're all for this free trade. And now it's time to pay the piper and let these folks have citizenship, let these folks have what they took away by allowing companies to go there and disrupt their way of lives.
Yep. No, Steve, you're absolutely right, and I totally agree with you. And we need to back out of these free trade agreements. Ross Perot was right. Steve, thank you for the call. James in Hebron, Indiana, you work at one of the factory scrubbers?
Yes, I do.
Okay, tell me about it.
We have a very high NOx removal rate at the scrubber. The NOx removal through the...
What's NOx?
The other part, not nitrous oxide.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
The other, there's two parts of every air quality system, the NOx removal and the SOx removal. And the SOx removal is actually very efficient. It's about 97%.
That's the sulfur dioxide.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And through a wet FGD process, fluid mm-hmm. gas desulfurization.
Mm-hmm.
It's very efficient, and there is actually very extremely tight regulations on the wastewater that comes from the FGD,
mm-hmm.
and they're actually tightening it again through the mercury and air toxicity standards that should be out now, I believe, through the EPA.
Okay. So do these scrubbers do a decent job of pulling things like mercury out, or could they do a better job? I mean, there's not a single lake or river in the United States any longer where the fish are safe to eat on a regular basis because of mercury coming out of coal-fired power plants?
Well, what they have is they have basically wastewater treatment plants, just like in any municipality, attached to these units that actually do take out the mercury. It's not taken out during the process. It basically just stays in the process.
So they take the mercury out of the coal before it's burned?
No, after. They take it out of the
fly ash.
No. It's still in the fly ash too. But
yeah.
Most of it gets transported through the flue gas,
right?
Which is the emissions to the water inside the FGD.
Right.
And then that water gets treated.
Okay, so the water is what is used to capture the particulate matter. But you know, some of that mercury is in the form of a gas. I mean, when you turn on a fluorescent light, the reason that fluorescent light lights up the way it does is because it has a mercury gas in a mercury vapor, it's called. How do you get gaseous mercury out of coal, out of coal-fired power plant exhaust?
Basically by either treating coal with a chemical, by getting it out more efficiently, or by better combustion.
Yeah.
Low NOx burners, those kind of things. And so,
how would better combustion change anything? Mercury is an element. It won't burn.
Right. But it also, it depends on what type of mercury it is, what the elemental form of it is.
Right. Whether it's ethyl or methyl, aren't those the two primary forms?
Correct.
Yeah. And methyl mercury is, go ahead.
What ends up happening is we actually have mercury monitors on our emissions saying this is the limit, and we always have to be below that, or on a 24-hour, 3-hour, and a 30-day limit. And we report those numbers out to the EPA.
Right. Okay. My understanding is that, you know, that basically the industry is pulling out all the mercury that they can within a, quote, reasonable price range, and that they're to the point where to take out the rest of the mercury would be far more expensive. The first bit of the mercury is less expensive than the very last little bit. And does that make sense to you?
Yes, it does. And, and that's exactly correct. Is the new MATS regulation, which is Mercury Air Toxicity Standard, is very functional for that last little bit, but it's actually reducing our limits even by half, which we're below at my power plant, but some other of the older power plants without the scrubbers and whatnot are not. But even with when you have the gas-fired units, they also have air quality things that they have to meet as well.
Sure. Yeah, natural gas contains a lot of these things as well. James, thank you. Thank you for the information. Thanks for calling. We get the smartest listeners on Earth. And they do everything. They work on scrubbers. It's amazing. Thanks, James. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio on every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television on both Dish Network and DirecTV and cable systems nationwide by the Free Speech TV Network. Yesterday, I brought up the issue of, you know, actually somebody called in, several people called in about what was going on in Brazil. And my knowledge of that was pretty cursory. So I said, you know, we'll get somebody on who really knows what they're talking about. Today, I pointed out that China's credit markets, according to the New York Times, froze up overnight. And there are various theories about this. I shared three of them with you. But again, I'm not an expert on these things, so let's talk to one. Mark Weisbrot is with us. He is back with us. He's been on the program before. He's co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, CEPR, the co-author with Dean Baker of the book Social Security, The Phony Crisis. Their website site is CEPR, as in Center for Economic and Policy Research, CEPR.net. And Mark, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Tom.
It's great to have you with us. So which do you want to take first, China or Brazil?
Your pick.
Okay, let's start with China, because I'm guessing Brazil's going to take a little longer. And what do you think's going on in China?
Well, you know, you've had the growth of this, the kind of a shadow banking system like we have in the U.S. instead of just, you know, banks making loans. There's these, they're offering these products to at higher interest rates people, and they're taking advantage of the fact that the government, like here, well, even more, you know, has to bail them out when they get into trouble. And so they're making risky loans, and so the government has tried to clamp down on that recently by allowing the interbank lending rate to rise. That is the interest rate that they pay each other, so as not to give them this kind of free ride. But it's disturbed a lot of things in the markets and everything else. So they're going to have to deal with that. But I don't think, you know, you see these analogies in the press to kind of what happened here. And I think that that's really not analogous. I mean, they don't have a giant bubble that's going to burst and cause a recession like we had here. Nothing like that is going to happen there. The government still controls the banking system. And this is just a question of, you know, basically developing stronger regulation so it doesn't get like something we had here. Okay. But, you know, there's a big misunderstanding of what happened here and the cause of the Great Recession and everything. You know, it wasn't so much a financial crisis as it was the bursting of this giant housing bubble. In other words, the financial crisis really only lasted a few months, and the recession was really a result of the loss of, you know, well, construction. Housing equity and the construction industry, you know, the huge slowdown in construction. So they're not going to have that. They've got some problems, but they're dealing with them. And so the idea that, you know, the economy is going to melt down there, I think, is way overblown.
Okay. And Brazil, we're, you know, again, a big day of demonstrations down in Brazil. This started off with people protesting, as I recall, a 10-cent, roughly equivalent increase in the cost of bus fares in a couple of their major cities. And now it's gone national, and the protests have expanded to other issues. Tell us about this.
Well, yes, it started out with bus fare increase, and then, you know, there were other issues raised, a whole variety of people, because a lot of these people that are involved have not been involved in politics before, but they were reacting to things they didn't like about the government, some legitimate grievances, for example, the spending of tens of billions of dollars on the World Cup, and then 2016 Olympics, and they want more spending on healthcare and education. You know, things like that. Now, you also have a right-wing media in Brazil. The media is extremely anti-government because you have a left government. Mm-hmm. So the media has put their own spin on it. Some of that has spilled over into the international press. In other words, they put forth things, complaints that they have.
Which is that it's government corruption and this kind of
inflation, too. They tried to make it like it's a big deal about inflation. The New York Times had a whole article with graphs about that. Inflation is really, it's fairly low. It's 6.5%, which for a developing country and for Brazil is not really high. It's at the upper end of their target range from the central bank. So the inflation, you know, that's been exaggerated. And corruption. I mean, so the right-wing media will use it to discredit the government.
That's interesting. But, now, Brazil has... Brazil has a national health care system, and you can get a free college education there. Correct me if I'm wrong.
No, that's right, but it's not as widespread as it should be. And it's, you know, I think it's a very legitimate complaint for people to say that this money should be spent on health care education. They could spend more. But, you know, this is also a left government. That's different. I mean, you know, if you look at all the Occupy protests and the kind of social media spread protests throughout the world, you know, Spain, the Arab Spring of those countries, Italy, the Five Star Movement. I mean, these were all protests against governments that were not left-wing, even if they were kind of nominally like the PSOE in Spain, the Socialist Party. Mm-hmm. You know, but this is an actual left government, and they've brought, you know, it's qualitatively different from all previous governments in recent history in Brazil. I mean, they've reduced poverty by 45%. Unemployment is at a record or near record lows. You know, inequality has been reduced. Growth has been twice as fast as it had been over the previous 25 years. So, you know, they've accomplished quite a bit. And I think, I mean, if you're interested in the politics, I think that, you know, It's one of several left governments in the region, of course. Most of the governments now in South America are left governments. And this government has pursued a more gradualist approach than, say, Ecuador, Bolivia, Venezuela, or even Argentina. And on the other hand, they've accomplished quite a bit. And but because they've pursued this gradualist approach, you know, a lot of people don't realize how different they are from the other governments. When you, you know, when you're like Rafael Correa in Ecuador, or Evo Morales in Bolivia, where it was kind of the end of an apartheid system where the indigenous majority didn't even have, you know, participation in the government. You know, there's a striking change and everybody knows it. You know, in Brazil, I mean, the economic changes have been big, and that's why, you know, Dilma still has a high approval rating, and her predecessor Lula, the two of them both had the highest approval of any president.
Did she, when she was elected, when she replaced Lula, did she move to the right, to the left, or did she stay the course?
I think she pretty much stayed the course. And in fact, on economic policy, she continued the move away from the neoliberal economic policies that Lula had begun. But it wasn't a drastic rate. It wasn't kind of like, again, in the other countries that I mentioned, where there was a sharper, much sharper change in economic policy, and in the other countries you had also a bigger expansion of social programs than you had in Brazil. But you had, again, these really significant changes because of the government's changes in economic policy. And yeah, Dilma's definitely moved in the same direction.
Right. So we have just a minute left, Mark. So we have a right-wing press, you have a left-wing government. How much of the outrage in the streets is being stirred up against the government by the right-wing press?
I don't think it is. I think, no, I think they're really, you know, the movement is mostly, it's good people with legitimate demands. And
so this is more J-curve stuff. People's expectations are not being met.
That's right. That's right. You have rising expectations. You have people who have legitimate complaints. And you have a government that has reacted very differently from other governments, you know, not like Turkey or anywhere. They've said, you know, the president has said, these protests are good. We appreciate it.
She's running for re-election next year.
She's running for re-election, but she didn't try to, you know, she could have said, you know, seized upon the small group of people who were violent, something like that. She didn't do that.
Yeah. Okay. Mark Weisbrot, a co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, co-author of Dean Baker of Social Security, The Phony Crisis. The website's CEPR.net. Mark, it's always an honor and a pleasure to have you with us. Thanks for dropping by today.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Thank you. 15 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And be sure to check out the Center for Economic and Policy Research, CEPR.net, is just a wealth of great information. Past the hour, it's the Tom Hartman Program, the True People's Media, and Lamar Waldron on the line with us, historian and author. His most recent book, Watergate, The Hidden History. The website is watergatethehiddenhistory.com. Not surprising. Hey, Lamar.
Tom, great to be talking with you again.
Welcome back. Thank you for joining us. So we have a couple of significant anniversaries with regard to Watergate coming up.
Right. Well, we've had a couple, and we've got a big one we've actually had one, and we've got a big one today. The Watergate break-in arrest anniversary, when the men were arrested at the Watergate, was on the 17th. But today is, I believe, June the 20th. Today is the anniversary of the 18-minute gap that has infamously existed and resisted all attempts to find out what was on it. However, the new information we'll be talking about today, you know, finally helps to explain what that 18-minute gap was all about and why there were so many other gaps that are not as famous in Nixon tapes from that day, including, you know, one entire tape that's completely missing. And then coming up on the 23rd is the anniversary of the smoking gun tape. And once again, what we'll be talking about today really explains why on that smoking gun tape Nixon kept talking about Cuba, Cuban exiles, and the Bay of Pigs from April of 1961, which happened after Nixon had left office as vice president. That happened in January of 1961. So that's perplexed a lot of people for years. But again, we've got new information straight.
Well, let's lay it out, Lamar. Where do you want to start?
Well, it's probably good to actually tell some of the younger people just really briefly, why are we talking about ancient history today? And there's several good reasons, because it's not ancient history. So much of what America is suffering with today dates from the Nixon era, when Nixon was president, or in some cases, when Nixon was vice president. You know, the fact that you and I cannot go to Cuba, no one in America can just, you know, hop down to Cuba in the middle of winter for a relaxing time, or, you know, to tell the Cuban people how great American democracy is. That's all thanks to Richard Nixon. That was
1959, when he was vice president with Eisenhower, right?
That's exactly right. And then on into 60. So we have that to thank. Roger Ailes and Fox News. Roger Ailes began working for Nixon in 1968. He was his media guy.
In fact, he proposed GOP TV, and Nixon turned him down, and so he took it to Rupert Murdoch.
And it's just amazing.
Now it's called Fox News.
Fox News today is like Richard Nixon writ large. I mean, it is the Nixonian tactics of fear, ignorance, bigotry, and smear, you know, 24 hours a day all across America. But you know, more personal things than that. I mean, I'm always shocked, and I saw a new chart just the other day. Whenever you see these charts that showed the decline of the American middle class's wealth, the decline of the real value of the minimum wage, the decline in the effective tax rate paid by a lot of the biggest corporations, just so many things like that, the decline in union membership, that all began under President Nixon. And those trends were just simply accelerated when a lot of his people and supporters, you know, recovered after Watergate and just kept on doing what they're doing. And those trends that started under Nixon are continuing today. And then, you know, one of the biggest things is that the corporations and the super wealthy funneling millions of dollars to influence campaigns, you know, that really, really took off and began under Nixon. In some cases, semi-legally, in some cases legally, but in many cases, just blatantly illegally. And here are the two most important reasons Nixon's still relevant today. The IRS controversy that we keep hearing about it all the time on television stems from a 1959 rule change made while Nixon was vice president and getting ready to run what was going to be a tough campaign against the son of one of America's richest men, and that candidate he was running against was John F. Kennedy. So hard to say how much impact Nixon had on that rule change, which just has perplexed people ever since. Certainly wasn't something that President Eisenhower was interested in, and Eisenhower had a lot of health problems. So it would not surprise me if Nixon weren't laying some future groundwork with that rule change that's now plaguing us today. And finally, the biggest thing, perhaps, is that the national security state that we find ourselves in today really began when Richard Nixon was vice president in the 1950s and what was called the McCarthy era, but should have been called the Nixon era because it lasted far long. You know, Nixon lasted well past McCarthy. And then to spread the blame around, the national security state did grow under Lyndon Johnson. But then it really took off under Nixon, and it was Nixon who specifically started using parts of that national security state, sometimes officially, sometimes when he formed his own little criminal intelligence units unofficially, to go after his opponents. And I don't mean, you know, in what happened in these recent IRS cases where, you know, some applications simply got additional scrutiny because, you know, it looked like they may be trying to skirt the law. I mean, they would go hard after their people. They would have the IRS, you know, target anybody. If you pointed out that Richard Nixon's best friend and business partner, Bebe Rebozo, had any ties to the mafia, if you even raised that possibility or looked like you were going to, you could get audited just like Newsday was. So, and that didn't happen to one or two or ten people. That happened to dozens of people, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners have heard of that enemies list. So it's important, again, to stress that, Obama can be criticized about many things, but one thing that it's not accurate to say about him is that Obama is another Nixon.
No.
A lot of Republicans.
Nixon was a genuine crook. Obama, at the very worst, is an ineffective politician. And I'm not sure he's all that ineffective, but I mean, I think that's the strongest charge you could make against him.
That's right. And the important thing, I think, that the critics of Obama should really focus on is, and even people that aren't critics of Obama, but need to look at this hard, is that I think a lot of people trust Obama, but if these tools are put in the hands of of a Republican president the next time, you know, we could easily have another Nixon, because these things do just keep, you know, on happening.
I think Ted Cruz is another Nixon, but that's a whole other thing. Lamar, I'd like to get into what was in that 18-minute tape, that 18-minute gap. Why did Watergate happen? Who were the Watergate burglars? I mean, there's so much territory to cover. Can you stick around for a little bit?
Sure, no problem.
Okay, we got a newscast here coming up and a commercial break, and then we'll be back with Lamar Waldron, historian and author of Watergate, The Hidden History. His website, WatergateTheHiddenHistory.com. Check it out. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Watergate. Lamar also wrote a book called Legacy of Secrecy, which is being made into a movie with Leo DiCaprio and Robert De Niro. It's the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program, and Lamar Waldron is with us, the historian and author. His most recent book, Watergate, The Hidden History, the website WatergateTheHiddenHistory.com. Lamar, welcome back.
Great to be back with you, Tom.
So, the 18-minute gap. By the way, this is Lamar's book. Whoop, wrong side. This is Lamar's book, Watergate, The Hidden History. So what is the what was in that 18-minute gap that Rosemary Woods had to stretch so far for? Clearly, that's not what happened. I mean,
it's important to stress that.
In fact, let's start out by telling people what the 18-minute gap was. Nixon had a recording system and all this kind of stuff.
I have another idea, because a lot of your listeners are probably much too young to remember Watergate. Let's kind of start a little bit back at the beginning.
Sure.
About what Watergate was all about, and actually we can let a mafia godfather tell us what Watergate was all about, because that's what we have that's brand new for the first time, is the words of an actual mafia godfather saying this is what Watergate was about, and then that will explain the gaps, and you know it'll be very obvious to people what it was, because people should understand that for Watergate. You know, Nixon, all the spin they put out, the cover-up worse than the crime, all that kind of crap, that was just, you know, spin. Nixon was a master of the media, which is why Watergate and the arrest were no impact at all on the 1972 election, none, because Nixon was such a master of the press, and the press overwhelmingly supported Nixon. The few that didn't, like the Washington Post or Newsday, Los Angeles Times, New York Times, they were the rare exceptions. So what Nixon was doing was using his political crimes unit to target his political opponents. And for Watergate, he used one of those political crimes units. He had several to try to keep from having his longstanding mafia ties exposed, particularly two huge mafia bribes of up to $1 million each. One of those $1 million mafia bribes just months before the first Watergate burglary. Now, here's where we're getting this new information that's in the, I should stress, this new information is only in the trade paperback of Watergate, The Hidden History. It wasn't in the hardback last year, but this is so new, this is so fresh, it's only in the new trade paperback.
New and improved.
Last week. What happened in the spring of 1973, the Watergate arrests were, as I said earlier, June 17th, 1972, almost a year later, not quite. There was a very prominent attorney, still alive today, but not in the news like he was, F. Lee Bailey, who was the most prominent attorney at that time. I mean, he was famous in a way that Johnny Cochran wasn't even famous when Cochran was alive. I mean, he was famous in a media figure far beyond any current attorney. I cannot think of an attorney to compare him to today. So if you combine the top two or three attorneys on television,
he was a rock star.
He was a total rock star. Yeah. And he had two interesting clients in the spring of 1973. One was one of the Watergate defendants, a former CIA officer for the Central Intelligence Agency. But his other client in the spring of 1973 was Florida godfather Santo Trafficante Jr., who headed the American side of the French Connection heroin smuggling ring, one of the more powerful and crafty godfathers in all of America. He didn't rule unchallenged a huge territory like, say, Carlos Marcello did. He didn't have the, you know, 1,000 square miles or something, But he was very powerful because he was allied with Marcello. He was allied with the New York Mafia. So he was allied with the head of the Washington, D.C. Mafia, which most people don't realize today actually existed. So Santo Trafficante was one of F. Lee Bailey's clients. Now, there was a young attorney by the name of Daniel Sheehan who was working for F. Lee Bailey at that time. And, Tom, you and some of your listeners, when you hear the name Daniel Sheehan, you may say, wait, I've heard that name before. Does it ring a bell with you?
Yes. But tell us why.
And for your listeners, Daniel Sheehan had just come off the Pentagon Papers case that you see in the news all the time today because it was somewhat similar, not identical, but to what's happened in the recent
Daniel Ellsberg.
NSA spying case. That's right, Daniel Ellsberg getting those papers, secret papers, needlessly secret papers about the Vietnam War, giving them to the New York Times and getting them published, okay? So Sheehan had been part of that case. He had then left to join F. Lee Bailey's very small firm, but, you know, he joined a rock star firm. Years later, Sheehan would become very famous for the Karen Silkwood case, where the woman was killed because she was exposing corruption in the nuclear industry. A lot of other socially prominent cases, including helping to expose parts of Iran-Contra. So that's what Daniel Sheehan became. But at this time, he's just a young guy, just starting out. So he doesn't really have any clout. And so while Sheehan was working for Trafficante, he gets very confused because, you know, F. Lee Bailey, you know, they've got this new client, one of the Watergate defendants, and they're following that. And then F. Lee Bailey and the chief investigator for Bailey, you know, they're in touch with Santo Trafficante. So, and at the time, you can verify this, Tom, because you have a little gray hair like I do, the Mafia never came up related to Watergate.
Right.
Never.
Right.
I mean, that just wasn't mentioned at all. It wasn't mentioned by Woodward and Bernstein in any of the news coverage, even though, as we now know, two of the Watergate burglars were actually working for Santo Trafficante at the time.
Right.
So, but Sheehan wondered, well, what's going on here? What tie does Trafficante have to Water? You know, what's the deal here? And so he eventually learned from F. Lee Bailey's chief investigator, who had talked personally to Santo Trafficante about this. Here's what Santo Trafficante told Bailey's chief investigator. That in September 1960, facing a tough election battle against JFK, Vice President Nixon ordered the CIA to hire the Mafia to kill Fidel Castro because Nixon felt, having been vice president for 8 years, if Fidel Castro, who had just recently taken over Cuba, if he were shot and killed right before the election, that instead of going with young, unproven Senator John F. Kennedy, the American voting public would instead go for Richard Nixon. And so Nixon ordered the CIA to hire the Mafia. And Nixon had been getting support from the Mafia since 1946 in his first congressional race.
Right.
Now, what Nixon, what Trafficante didn't, oh, and by the way, Trafficante became part of those plots. So when he is talking to F. Lee Bailey's chief investigator about this, you know, Trafficante isn't speculating. He became part of those plots in September 1960.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as my book points out, that same month, September 1960, Trafficante and some of the other mobsters involved in the CIA Mafia plots for Nixon give Nixon a $500,000 bribe to stall charges against Jimmy Hoffa. So to Nixon, the plot to kill Fidel, the $500,000 bribe, that's like all one thing. That's all a lot of the same mobsters, and Trafficante is at the middle of both of those things.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Trafficante was using F. Lee Bailey for. He didn't want that to come out.
Right.
And it gets worse. As my book shows, just a few months before the first Watergate break-in, Trafficante and some of those same mobsters gave Nixon a new bribe, this time for $1 million, to let Hoffa out of prison with special conditions that the Mafia wanted, that Hoffa could not take over the Teamsters again because the mobsters like Trafficante were much happier with the replacement of Hoffa. Hoffa could be a tough guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so Trafficante got along with Hoffa, but they could order around the replacement for Hoffa much easily. So that's what Trafficante was sitting on in 1973.
Right. You got about a minute and a half here left.
He knew about the CIA mafia, the old bribe, and most importantly, he knew about the new bribe, and he did not want all that stuff to come out.
So the minute, the 18-minute gap in the tapes that Nixon was recording.
So what Nixon is talking about on those tapes are things related to those CIA mafia plots, because the general public and the Senate Watergate Committee really didn't know about those plots. They only started to learn about those plots the following year in 1974. So Nixon admitted a lot of crimes on tape, and people have wondered, well, if he admitted all these other crimes, and he did admit a lot of felonies, what could have been so terrible? What could have been so terrible was that if the CIA mafia plots came out, and the fact that they were mixed up with these huge bribes from the mafia, including the one for $1 million shortly before Watergate, Nixon would have simply had to resign. I mean, he would have been regarded as a crook. You and I remember that Nixon was the law and order president.
Right. He started the drug wars. I mean, you know.
That's right. And here's what was on the smoking gun tape. So why is Nixon talking about Bay of Pigs in Cuba and the Cubans and all this stuff? Well, the reason he's talking about that is Nixon ordered, this is from Trafficante, again, this is brand new information. Trafficante told FBI Bailey's chief investigator, Nixon himself asked for most of the people crew because they were veterans of the CIA mafia plot. So they could go in to the offices of the Democratic National Committee, headed by Bryan, look for those files, and you wouldn't have to tell anybody. You know,
What they were looking for.
Exactly, because they had worked, so they would recognize the names, the date. They would know what they found there. So,
So Watergate was all about Nixon not wanting it exposed that he was in the bag with the mob. The 18-minute tape was all about that. Basically, it was all about that.
That's exactly right.
I mean, you had to boil it down to a sentence or two. Lamar Waldron, historian and author, his new book, Watergate, The Hidden History, the new trade paperback just came out. WatergateTheHiddenHistory.com for more information. Lamar, thanks for dropping by today.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Great talking. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
That's WatergateTheHiddenHistory.com. Very, very intersidereally ugly, brought to you by Edison Factor, food for your brain, edisonfactor.com. The good Chipotle, the burrito chain, recently started labeling all genetically modified ingredients on its website with a big red G to GMO status. Amazingly, half of the 24 ingredients listed on Chipotle's website, which you can see over at their website, contain GMOs, which demonstrates the difficulty of obtaining natural foods in today's marketplace. Chipotle is the first major fast food chain to institute any sort of GMO labeling system, and they should be commended for a decision that is likely a huge business risk and may even turn away some customers. Good work, Chipotle. The bad. Tea Party supporters. According to a new study published in the journal Race and Social Problems, supporters of the anti-Obama, anti-tax, anti-government movement are significantly affected by racial attitudes towards African Americans. The study pooled together the responses of over 3,000 Americans to statements like, if blacks would only try hard, they would be just as well off as whites, and found that older white conservatives who identified as Tea Party sympathizers were much more likely than not to agree with such statements. Although the study's authors determined that there isn't enough evidence to conclude that the Tea Party itself is a purely racial movement, its authors did find that there was a strong association between its supporters' racial views and their attitudes towards our current president. Regardless, the very fact that its supporters find a haven for their racism within its ranks just doesn't reflect well on the Tea Party. And the very, very ugly Paula Deen, the celebrity chef, better known for her passionate defense of all things buttery, now finds herself embroiled in racial controversy. According to a lawsuit filed against Deen by a former employee of one of her restaurants, the chef told her that her dream wedding would be plantation-themed. She reportedly remarked, Well, what I would really like is a bunch of little N-words to wear longs, and she didn't say N-word, if you know what I mean, to wear long-sleeve white shirts, black shorts, and black bow ties. You know, in the Shirley Temple days, they used to dance around. Now, that would be a true Southern wedding, wouldn't it? And end of quote. In a deposition from the ongoing lawsuit, Dean tried to explain herself while admitting that she wanted a plantation wedding. She denied using the N-word and defended her other comments as just remarks praising a restaurant that had an all-black wait staff and represented a certain era in America. Whatever way you spin them, Dean's comments are just very, very ugly. That's incredibly ugly. Evelina, listening on KBBF in Santa Rosa, California. Hey, Evelina, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Well, a couple of things. First of all, I would like to challenge the current corporate mass media narrative on immigration. From immigration reform to peonage reform. And the reason behind that is that the current wording on the proposal is that people that would, the small percentage that probably will qualify, which will be about 20 to 30% of the 11 million, will have to work without a break of more than 60 days, which means that
for 13 years,
if they are unemployed for 60 days, they will be out of the reform and deported.
Right.
And the definition for peonage is it's a type of involuntary servitude where laborers have little control over their employment conditions that, as you know, was used in the time of slavery when whites used black codes in order to gain the forced labor of the African Americans that have been freed from slavery.
Well, let me add, my understanding is the peons, the peonage, that phrase, that word goes back to the times of feudalism, although serfs was, you know, another word associated with that. And that, you know, I've always said libertarianism and feudalism are essentially the same thing. So this is a very libertarian perspective.
Okay. And the other thing I did also want to say that the surveillance debacle should be an alarm to undocumented immigrants. It's a matter of time before the information that's on their Facebook and calls and phone calls will be used for deportation purposes. Mm-hmm. And also that the drones that FBI are using, the technology is advanced to the point where they're as small as mosquitoes.
Yeah. I've heard they were as small as dragonflies. Mosquitoes... Okay, Evelina, thank you for sharing with us, and particularly the insight on peonage. That's an excellent one. Bob in Westville, Florida. Hey, Bob, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Yeah, I've got a rewrite on the Pledge of Allegiance for the 1%.
Okay.
I pledge allegiance to Grover Norquist and to the Republican tax-free enterprise for which he stands. One corporation under Ayn Rand, indivisible. That is too big to fail, with deregulation and bailouts for all shareholders.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Bob, thanks a lot for calling and sharing that. That's a marvelous piece. Charlene in Nokomis, Illinois. Charlene, we have a minute to the end of the show.
Oh, great, Tom. I need to know what you think about the Catholic Church, the hypocrisy, and their motives for suing about this HHS mandate. I mean, they already told them that.
Well, it wasn't the Catholic Church. It was some Catholic hospitals, was it not?
Well, there's like 25 different organizations.
Right.
The bishops and everything are suing over it.
Oh, they are.
The Obama administration already told them you don't have to refer people yourself, that you can send them to the insurance company.
Right.
And number two, on Right to Life, they said they can't do this because they believe in Right to Life. Well, what about half of every dollar, you know, going to these wars where they're killing, thousands?
My understanding, Charlene, you wanted my opinion on this. My understanding is that it was the Catholic hospitals who were saying, we don't want to, you know, be forced to provide, you know, birth control or whatever, these other things. And that if you want to be in the hospital business, that's not the church business. And so you shouldn't, you know, you have to abide by the laws that have to do with hospitals. So that's my opinion. Charlene, thank you for the call. Coming up tomorrow, it's Friday. Of course, that means it's Brunch with Bernie. America's Senator Bernie Sanders will be here talking about the important issues of the week and taking your calls. Plus, anything goes on Town Hall Friday. Bring us a topic and we'll have a conversation. And the best of the rest of the news. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Get over to free-don.com. pdamerica.org, movetoamend.org, occupy something, tag You're It. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.